Welcome to the latest Science Progress podcast. I am Andrew Pratt, Managing Editor of Science Progress. Today, we are joined by Professor Ed Maybach, who is the Director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Welcome, Professor Maybach.
Thank you, Andrew.
And as well, Center for American Progress Senior Fellow Andrew Light. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
And we are here to talk about a recent survey that came out of the Center for Climate Change Communication at GMU, talking to meteorologists about how they think about climate change and the kind of science reporting that they do as weathercasters on local news outlets around the country. So, Professor Maybach, can you describe a little bit about the report itself? Who did you end up talking to? Who were the people that you were surveying, and what were the findings?
So if I might, let me actually provide just a little bit of background.
Please.
The reason we did the survey is because we've surveyed members of the public repeatedly now, and among the many questions that we ask the members of the public, we ask, well, who do you trust? You know, among a variety of potential sources of climate change, in information about climate change, who do you trust? And what we have found is that weathercasters are the second most trusted source of climate change information to the American people, the most trusted source being scientists themselves. The gap between number two and number three, however, is pretty large.
Right.
And moreover, number three is a very amorphous group, friends and family. I trust what my friends and family have to tell me about it. So, you know, with regard to actual science-based sources of information about climate change, scientists themselves are number one, TV weathercasters number two. That clued us into the fact that our nation's weathercasters are a potentially important source of informal education about climate change. When we started this project, we didn't know the degree to which these professionals were providing that role, educating their viewers about the relationship between local weather and the changing global climate. So that really was the impetus for the survey. We wanted to know what these guys and gals were thinking and doing, and if they were not, the extent to which they were not currently acting as climate change educators, we wanted to identify the path to cultivate them as an important source of education for the public.
So what did you end up finding in sort of broad brushstrokes?
Contrary to what we had been led to believe, that TV meteorologists were just a hotbed of climate change skepticism, we found that, in fact, 55% of our respondents, and this was we started out to do a census, every one of the 1,300 meteorologists around the country, we got about a 50% response rate, so we ended up speaking to just under 600 people. And what we found is that 55% of them believe that climate change is real. Another 20% haven't yet made up their mind, and 25% believe that climate change is not real. So this notion that it's a hotbed of climate change skepticism turned out not to be the case. Really, that we see this as a glass already half full finding. Moreover, given that 20% of our respondents said they haven't made up their mind, we see it as a glass with a little bit of care and feeding that could be brought up to the three quarters full level.
Now, I've read in several different news outlets about the survey over the past few weeks, and a lot of those reports have focused on that approximately quarter of the respondents who agree with the statement or strongly agree with the statement that global warming is a scam. That's been the lead here, the doubt and skepticism. Can you talk a little bit about why that part is the focus when you're seeing this really as a glass half full moment?
It's a great question, and it's one that I can only speculate as to the reason. Mm-hmm. I suspect it has something to do with the negativity bias in the news, that bad news gets covered, good news tends to get ignored or made a second priority. Had this been a story that was covered as a good news story, it might have been featured, somewhere buried deep in the newspaper, as it was. Leslie Kaufman from the New York Times covered this as a front page story, and that's coverage like that is pretty hard to earn. So we were pleased that Leslie covered the story. I don't necessarily agree with her conclusions, which was, oh my God, there's a quarter of our nation's television weathercasters who are climate change deniers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, before we get into sort of the details of this opportunity, can we talk for just a moment about some of the findings that you came across about how weathercasters see themselves as filling in some of the gaps that have been left by science reporters leaving a lot of local news outlets?
So the gaps that have been created by science reporters leaving is a relatively newer phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that there has been a push by the American Meteorologic Society to cultivate weathercasters as the station scientist.
Really?
In most local television newsrooms, they are the only person who has any measure of scientific training.
Hmm.
And as a result, the AMS recognized an opportunity to turn the local weathercaster into the station scientist. This is something they've been at for a couple of years now, trying to cultivate this role, trying to educate their members to be able to fulfill the role well. And it's one that our survey showed that about 9 out of 10 of the nation's meteorologists, they like the role, they welcome the role, they embrace it. And it's not terribly surprising in that these are very social people. They're natural-born educators.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoy being in front of the camera. They enjoy explaining complicated concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the opportunity to extend that into the role of station scientist is one that they embrace.
And it seems to be a role, based on your survey findings, that extends outside of the newsroom. A lot of these weathercasters and meteorologists are also asked to speak at community gatherings on climate or weather-related issues. Is that also the case?
That's absolutely right. So these people, I often say these guys, and it's because most of them are men, most of them spend a fair amount of their professional time actually in community events, schools, other types of, you know, adult-oriented community gatherings, talking about the weather, talking about their role as a weatherman. It's a wonderful way for them to sort of build loyalty among a viewer base, and that loyalty that comes back to watch them do the daily news. So it's very much a part of their role. When it comes to educating their viewers about climate, what we found is that only a relatively small proportion of them are actually incorporating information about the changing climate into their weathercast, mm-hmm. but a relatively large proportion of them are finding ways to address the issue in their community presentations.
Interesting. And let me maybe ask a question that can bring you in for comment as well. Andrew, you mentioned what the American Meteorological Society is doing to help weathercasters be better science reporters. Are there other opportunities maybe that could be supported by public policy for improving the amount of information that they have and the opportunities that they have to communicate good science to the people who are watching?
One of the most surprising findings for me in our survey was the fact that 2 out of 3 of our respondents said they are interested in covering the issue of climate change. That wasn't the surprising part. That's gratifying.
Right.
The fact that the nation's weathercasters acknowledge the role that we were exploring with them in the first place. Are you willing to educate your viewers about the relationship between local weather and the changing global climate? 2 out of 3 essentially said yes, interested in doing that. Thanks. What was surprising is that group of people who said they embraced the role, 90% indicated that a variety of relatively simple resources that they do not currently feel they have access to would help them do their jobs more effectively. And to me, that's sort of the aha moment from the whole study. These resources aren't expensive resources to produce and to provide to them. Some of them could literally be provided overnight with the decision of the current content holders. So, for example, access to the peer-reviewed literature, to the journals. These guys and gals don't have easy access to those journals. The journals are run on a for-profit basis, and most of these people aren't associated with universities, as I am. I have access to the journals for free, even from home. They don't, and they told us that that's a real barrier for them. An even more important barrier, as a matter of fact, the number one barrier, which is a resource that could be fairly easily produced and provided to them, is access to graphics and animations that will help them explain complex scientific concepts related to how the global climate works and how that influences our local weather. Those are resources. 3 out of 4 people who said that they would could benefit from the access to these resources. 3 out of 4 people pointed to that as a resource that would greatly improve their ability to do that job well.
Wow. Andrew, are there opportunities for public policy to play a role? It sounds like maybe something as simple as increasing access to federally funded climate research might do that job.
Yeah, I think that's right. And here there's sort of two things I want to mention. One is the wealth of freely available information that there is that the federal government provides. Especially since the transition to the new administration, we've seen a push to really make these, at least the U.S. data sets, more broadly available on national climate impacts and assessments. I think that as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration moves towards creation of the National Climate Service, which they announced their intention to do just a few months ago, and they're going through a kind of a process now for what sort of reorganization would be needed internally to make that happen. We'll probably see some hearings in the House Science Committee in the fall about this and what sort of other kinds of administrative changes might be necessary. Then I think you'll see NOAA actually become the sort of the single repository. It really should be a one-stop place. It won't give you all the access to the detail that you get that Ed, I think, rightly pointed out you need with respect to the science journals, but it will nonetheless give you a more coordinated access to that kind of information. And I know that NOAA Minister Jane Lubchenco is really interested exactly in this gap between how we talk about climate, how we talk about weather, the need to sort of integrate these, and obviously having the National Climate Service and the National Weather Service all under the same umbrella ought to help to bridge that gap. The second thing, and this is a bit controversial, and I don't know if it has come up at any of the conversations you've had about the survey. You know, one of the things that was mentioned is that it's been proposed, in fact, Heidi Cullen, formerly of the Weather Channel, had proposed that in the accreditation that broadcast meteorologists do through the American Meteorological Association, they ought to be required to take a sort of a short course or something on climate. And that was for various reasons rejected by the AMS. But I do know that there are a number of people in the AMS, especially in the policy wing of it, who would like to see that happen. And they're trying to sort of figure out what is the best way which they can sort of move that ball a little bit forward down the field. And actually, I think, see the reaction to your survey is an opportunity for them internally to start talking about this again. So have you picked up any sense of how that might be received among the broadcast community?
It's a great question, and I received a lot of input on the survey, interestingly enough, before the survey was ever released. The survey itself was ever started, and I received a lot of feedback from individual meteorologists during the period of when we were fielding the survey, people who either were pleased to see it or were unhappy to see the nature of the questions we were asking. I've received really no formal or even informal feedback from members of the meteorology community since we released our findings. I think that very appropriately, I think that they're considering it. This is the largest survey of broadcast meteorologists ever conducted. It's certainly the most extensive. Our response rate was the best thus far, so it's the most representative. So I think the leadership of AMS, as well as their membership, who are interested in their own community of professionals and interested in taking it to the next level, I'm under the impression that they're considering these findings pretty carefully. I would imagine that Heidi Cullen's the spirit of Heidi Cullen's proposal is one that will eventually be adopted in one manner or another.
And can we explain for listeners what the accreditation process is for meteorologists who are working as weathercasters? Is a weathercaster a meteorologist? Is there a particular scientific background that someone's required to have? What does that seal mean?
Previous research, not our current study, has shown that about half of all of the currently practicing television weathercasters around the country are in fact meteorologists, meaning half are not. What we found is that there are two different professional societies in the meteorology community. There's the National Weather Association and the American Meteorologic Society. The National Weather Association offers a credential to their members. Conversely, their members do not have to be credentialed. They're free to continue continue in their employment. They're free to continue as members of the NWA without the credential. Same is true of the American Meteorologic Society, who they actually offer two different levels of credentialing. One is simply called the AMS seal, and the other is the CBM, AMS-CBM seal, the Certified Broadcast Meteorologist seal, the latter of which being the more rigorous of the two credentialing processes. About 15% of our respondents to the survey didn't hold any credential. So it's a diverse community. There are people who are, you know, certainly well-trained scientists. There are, conversely, there are also people who are coming at this more from a background in journalism or possibly even a more general background. They're good in front of a camera. They're comfortable with the role, and they've been given the opportunity to do the job.
And picking up on that, I want to sort of loop that back to the point you were making at the beginning about the trust that members of the public invest in professional climate scientists, people who are traditionally academic researchers. What is the level of trust that weathercasters and meteorologists have for climate scientists and their conclusions about global warming?
We asked that specific question, and what we found is that approximately three out of four of our respondents look at climate scientists as a trustworthy source of information about climate change. That's good news. It's good news because it says this, you know, there's sort of a mythology that has developed very recently about a gap in the culture between meteorologists and climatologists. And, you know, that mythology basically sort of falls out along the following lines. Well, we meteorologists struggle to create weather models that are accurate 10 days out. It's hubris for climate scientists to be asking us to place our faith in climate models that are play out over many decades. The fact that three out of four meteorologists look to climate scientists as credible sources of information about climate change, to me, is an indicator that, in fact, you know, it is more of a mythology than a reality, that there isn't necessarily a culture gap between the two communities.
And I think that's interesting, the way in which I think that the media did, in their first, you know, look at this report, kind of hype and sort of come up with this as the explanation, a kind of a, you know, seat of the pants sociology, right, of the working class meteorologists, right, who don't get no respect, right, the Rodney Dangerfields, right, of the climate world, and then, you know, the highfalutin scientists in their white lab coats, you know, running their fancy computer models, and what do they know? And I think that in that respect, it's good to put this in context, to just go back to really the beginning of why did the Times originally cover this as such a negative spin story, which I think obviously influenced the rest of the coverage on it, is we can't forget about the fact that this survey came out sort of, I think, still continuing in the midst of, you know, what we're calling, for lack of a better term, ClimateGate, starting last November with the hack of the emails from the climate research unit at the University of East Anglia in London, or in England, and then continuing forward to these, you know, two, three fairly minor in the grand scheme of things, mistakes in the IPCC fourth assessment report. And so what I think that some folks who really wanted to continue to squeeze some more juice out of that story, they see your study and they go, oh, great, here's another pool of experts who disagree with these people who we have now reason to distrust now because of their sloppy science and their big reports and the fact that they're doing these nefarious things that have been covered in these emails, when, of course, as we know, that none of that, I mean, has really changed any of the overwhelming scientific consensus on the causes of anthropogenic global warming and what are the necessary solutions. In that context, I wanted to sort of see, I mean, one of the things that I think your survey, probably you didn't foresee this when you were doing it, but you sort of created another opportunity for the talking heads phenomenon. So, you know, Bill Nye, the science guy, right, versus, you know, some broadcast weatherman who's sort of disagreeing with it. It was on the Colbert Report. You had, you know, a scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists going up against a broadcast meteorologist. I mean, even lampooning the phenomenon of the talking heads that were launched by this. To my mind, that doesn't help. I mean, whenever we get into anything on CNN, which is one side versus the other side. You know, you've kind of lost control, right, of any kind of sane message that could come out of whatever topic they're discussing. So how did that sort of strike you coming out of this?
Yes. So setting the whole notion of setting it up as a debate does absolutely reinforce that there is the notion that there is disagreement in the scientific community about climate change. And that's a totally erroneous notion because, in fact, that the best data we have was a survey published in EOS last year of Earth scientists from around the world, the majority of which, interestingly enough, were U.S.-based Earth scientists. And the paper did a very nice job of stratifying Earth scientists into people with qualitatively different types of training. Among the climate scientists, particularly among the climate scientists who are active researchers, they are in almost perfect consensus about the fact that climate change is real and human-caused. 96-97% of them respond that climate change is real and it is human-caused. So this notion that there is still disagreement out there in the scientific community about climate change is fundamentally wrong, and it's specifically wrong about the experts who know the issue best. I liken it to, if I'm having trouble with my home air conditioner, and I bring three people to my home to give me an estimate about, an assessment of what's wrong and how much it's going to cost me to fix it. If one of them happens to be a carpenter and the other is a plumber and the third's an air conditioning tech person, I really would be well served to pay most attention to what the AC guy tells me about the problem with my air conditioner. The interesting thing is of all of the Earth scientists who were surveyed, the only group that showed really significant amounts of disagreement about climate change being real and human-caused were a group that I frankly had never even heard of before called economic geologists, which, as I understand it, are the people who ply their trade of geologists for the benefit of the fossil fuel companies. So, yes, they do, in fact, have a certain amount of disagreement there, but they have a strong economic motivation not to buy into climate change. The other Earth scientists, there really isn't any significant remaining disagreement. And so if, in fact, I have inadvertently fueled this notion of a debate, I take the opportunity to assert at any chance possible that there may be debate about what should be done, but there is no debate about what is going on. And the scientists themselves are perfectly clear on that point.
And I'd like to pick up on one aspect of your survey that focuses on some of the stuff that is going on at the community level, which is the interest that your meteorologist respondent said in conveying information, science information about disasters, local level health problems, agricultural catastrophes. These are sort of the local or regional level impacts that climate research says are happening now and are going to continue to worsen. Can you talk a little bit about the opportunity there for helping meteorologists do the reporting and communication on those issues?
And that is precisely why this is such a great opportunity. This being enabling local weathercasters to make the connection between the conditions we are living with here in our community and the changing global climate. The reason that's such a great opportunity is because members of the American people, we have this sense of climate change. Even people who care pretty strongly about the issue, we have a sense of climate change that it's happening somewhere else. And more likely, it hasn't yet started happening. It will happen at some point in the future. We understand there's a problem, but it isn't our problem. That's an important misperception that needs to be changed. The U.S. government's report from last summer, the impact of global climate change in the United States makes perfectly clear that it's happening here, it's happening now. Yet the American people haven't yet caught on to that fact. So local weathercasters are a potentially important set of educators, cadre of educators, who can help bridge that disconnect.
Yeah. And part of this resonates with work that you've done previously in your research career on public health. A lot of these impacts are actually not just going to be economic or agricultural or hotter weather, but they're going to make people less healthy, and we're gonna bear the economic burden of taking care of our fellow citizens, right?
We're really enchanted with this notion that an environmental framing, the way in which the climate change story has been framed historically as an environmental problem. I am a public health person by training, and you know, as a result of 25 or more years in the field, I'm absolutely convinced that the American people, health is right up there along with baseball mom and apple pie for the American people. It is such a deeply held value. And we are currently doing, Matt Nisbet at American University and I are currently doing research looking at the potential to help the American people understand the issue differently by reframing it as a public health problem, a threat to human health and well-being. And our sense is it will help engage a broader cross-section of Americans if we do that and engage them at a fundamentally deeper, more values-based level. And we have a paper under review right now, which is sort of preliminary support for that idea.
Interesting.
Yeah, and just on that, I mean, I think that totally unreported in the coverage about the report. For example, question number 40, where you go through, you ask the survey, the population here, over the next 20 years, do you think global warming will cause more or less of the following? And you go through the whole list of impacts, hurricanes, extinction of species, all this. And if you really look at the numbers, they're actually pretty good. I mean, in terms of what this sample, this population thinks, I mean, you've got over, you know, 30, over 40% of people sort of saying famines and food shortages, you know, are going to be worse in the future because of global warming. They really are making the causal connections here against, I think, the sort of the way that this was reported. And that's where I think something – there's a really powerful opportunity here, because one of the things that we see – there's really two kinds of phenomenon. On the one hand, politically, for example, this administration doesn't want to talk about climate impacts, and so it doesn't really want to talk about public health when they're talking about moving forward a piece of climate change legislation. They want to talk about jobs, and they want to talk about energy security and kind of national security as a sort of a cluster of issues. And for those of us sort of tracking the debate on whether or not we actually are going to get a Senate bill to match the House bill and kind of move forward, it's really hard to see that any more sort of attention to the jobs and energy security stuff is going to get us another single vote in the U.S. Senate. I mean, we clearly are at a desperate need right now for other arguments, and so people will turn to climate impacts, including the public health dimensions of climate impacts, as something we ought to go back and pick up again. Then you've got this problem. Scientists are terrible communicators, right? They're awful at it. And so we've got fixes out there, things like the Aldo Leopold Fellowship program, which tries to take mid-career scientists and teach them how to speak to the media and teach them how to speak to government. The Pew Oceans Trust does a similar thing just for ocean scientists. There are other groups out there like that. The fact of the matter is that we actually need people who are better at communicating to be able to do something right now on this, rather than waiting to bring up to speed a bunch of climate scientists, for example. And so reaching out to this population, just getting them to be more to find an opportunity not only in their community work but also with respect to what they're doing at their local stations to talk about their suspicion of these impacts would be just totally valuable. Absolutely. I think to advance this debate.
Absolutely. And a related project to this survey is actually the predecessor project to the survey is we went out through something called a snowball sample, word of mouth, to try to find local TV weathercasters who were really doing a great job of educating their viewers about the relationship between local weather and the changing global climate. And we were able to find less than two dozen people who were really embracing this role actively. It's one thing to embrace it; it's another to actually live it. And so we found about 18 people, I believe, and we conducted very long interviews with them. We've asked them to provide us with their material. We're assessing that right now to see what they're doing and how that stacks up to best practices in informal science education. But the fact that we've got hundreds and hundreds of people out there who embrace the role conceptually, but we could only identify less than two dozen who are actually currently practicing the role, certainly bespeaks the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Well, as sort of a final question, what are the next steps for this kind of research? Where is the Center on Climate Change Communication going to go next, and what should we look for?
So for us, the next step is the third and final piece of research in this NSF-funded grant, mm-hmm. and that is we're working with the CBS affiliate in Columbia, South Carolina, WLTX. Their weather team, headed by Jim Gandy, is very excited about this role, becoming climate change educators in their community. And so we are we're working with Heidi Cullen at Climate Central to develop some broadcast-ready educational graphics and animatics, exactly the kind of thing that our survey respondents said they most want, they most need in order to do this job better. Jim and the weather team at WLTX will, starting in June and for the next year, they'll be using these materials that we create for them in a variety of ways to try to help their viewers better understand the nature of climate change and how it influences the weather there in the Columbia, South Carolina area. If, in fact, we can demonstrate the ability for the CBS affiliate to educate their viewers about this important global issue and make it local, that will have been a real victory. And we think that will be a very, very strong sign that this is an idea that really ought to be, you know, scaled up and rolled out nationwide.
That sounds really exciting. Well, Professor Maybach, Director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at GMU, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this survey today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks as well, Andrew Light, who is a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress on our Energy Opportunity Team. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.